A time for a while when I was a kid that I was really into cults. And it should not surprise you that I was kind of a weird kid. So it was 1997, the year that Heaven's Gate made the news, the cult that was founded by Marshall Applewhite. And they were based in San Diego, California. And I was fascinated because that was just 4 hours from where I lived. They were there when 39 of its members lost their lives. And I think that was my first real memory of what loss and the end of life could mean and how it could have this ripple effect across the country. So I was in middle school, and when I heard this new story on the news, I became obsessed, not just with Heaven's Gate, but I used my newly acquired research skills to go to the public library and read every book there was to find on other cults. So this phase didn't last long because when my research questions transformed to what is a cult and what were famous cults to how do you start a cult, my mom began encouraging more wholesome hobbies. But still, I was fascinated by the idea of what made people decide to follow someone else at all costs. Perhaps it's a little ironic, or at least not surprising, that I ended up studying religion. I think my childhood question has followed me in some form or another. How do we know who or what to follow? How do we find our moral compass? In a world with so many competing messages and contradictory beliefs, how do we decide what is right or good? The people in the early Christian church were asking the same questions. In particular, the church in Corinth, Greece, was in the middle of an old-fashioned church split, or since they were one of the first Christian churches, a newly fashioned church split. Among other disagreements, the members of the church couldn't decide which leader to follow, Apollos or Paul. Whose style of leadership should they look to? Who was going to be the answer to their prayers? Whose church was it? Luckily for the church in Corinth, Paul heard about this argument and wrote them a letter, but he didn't say, "Me, of course, pick me, it's my church." He set his ego aside and redirected them toward their creator God. He says, "I planted and Apollos watered, but God made it grow. Because of this, it doesn't matter who plants or waters. They are nothing without God. We are God's servants working together, and you are God's field, God's building." This is one of my favorite images of God in the whole Bible. Whoever is in charge of our world, whether it's in a church, in a town, or in the government, their leadership should point us back to God, not to themselves. In this image, leadership's goal is to plant and support other people's gifts, but to acknowledge that the source of those gifts always comes from our Creator. Paul uses a beautiful metaphor of us being a field that has been planted and watered, and it is God that gives us the growth. In other words, when we are fighting over who has the best ideas or is the smartest or the most powerful, the answer is none of us, because none of us can compare to God. The image of God as someone who helps us to grow is an image of love. It is a metaphor of nurturing, supporting, guiding, and encouraging love. As fields with seeds that have been planted in them, our job is to stay open to the growth that is yet to happen and yet to come. I love this because as an inspiring but often lackluster gardener, I know that I cannot control growth. I know that even if I water my seeds or plants the recommended amount and give them enough sunlight and play them Mozart and take them in every night, there's something bigger than myself that happens that ultimately provides for their growth. If you've ever tried your hand at gardening, you know that when it happens, it is a source of mystery and awe for the ways in which we are connected to processes that we cannot see or fully understand but get to participate in. When we put God back in the equation, the question then becomes, how do we know we are following God and allowing God to nurture our growth and not something else? What sets God's growth apart, and how do we recognize it? With a gardening image, how do we not mistake it for a weed, pluck it out of the earth, and toss it in the trash? How do we keep in our garden those plants that are pollinators for the bees, or provide food for our families, or work with other plants to strengthen each other like the three sisters of beans, corn, and squash? The answer lies in grounding ourselves in our faith, in tracing back through our tradition and through our scriptures to discovering a God of love and mercy, a God that forgives its people over and over again, a God that cares about those who have been left out, marginalized, and oppressed, a God that stands on the side of justice. These are movements that transcend whoever is in power at this moment today or whoever will be in power next year. It would be easy to say all we have to do is sit back and let God help us grow. It's a very Jesus take the wheel kind of image. But growing toward God and through God requires a practice we call discernment. Discernment is the art of finding the intersection of who we are and who God calls us to be. Discernment requires listening for how God is urging us to move, respond, or what we are called to do. It is placing our life in the context of our spiritual values and allowing that spirituality to be our guide. Discernment can be done alone in conversation with God, but it can also be done in the context of a group. Discernment happens when we ask questions like, why are we here? And where are we going? It is when we reflect on past moments in our lives that felt similar to this one and what we have learned from them that might inform us today. When we practice discernment, the purpose is not to give answers, but to ask clarifying questions that help an answer emerge organically. Discernment is a part of many Christian traditions and takes different forms, all seeking to discover how God is calling us. In other words, what kind of growth we're encouraged to nurture and how we might lean into that life-giving growth. One of my favorite discernment practices is that of the Clearness Committee out of the Quaker tradition. Clearness committees come together when someone has a problem or a question they are wrestling with. And in the group context, you ask open, honest questions. There is no fixing, no advising, no saving, and no correcting. You simply keep asking the questions, allowing the person at the center to trust their inner teacher and find the answers they seek. Clearness committees are always done in the context of worship, reminding them that God is at the center of all they seek. Here at Edgewood, we do not have a formal process of discernment, but it is something that is informally woven into the life of our church. It is what we call on our committees and ministry teams to do as they navigate the direction for our congregation and decide what issues we should take up and commit to as a faith community. Our justice teams at Edgewood are actually discernment teams. The green team, our open and affirming team, the racial justice team, and our justice and peace team. These folks are constantly asking themselves questions and trying to find clarity about how we are guided to respond to the pressing justice issues of our time. I am continually impressed because I know the members of these teams to be inundated with different issues of injustice in our community and world. Individually, They have their pulse on the finger of where there is a need for justice in places all across the globe and right here at home. I could not attempt to list the issues they are involved in because it would be near impossible to capture them all. But these folks don't come to Edgewood bringing their individual agendas. They come together and say, given all that is happening in the world, given all there is to do, what is Edgewood called to respond to? Which of these issues speak to the heart of our church, or where should we be using our voice to amplify the concerns of others? They ask questions about what is happening in our community, where there is work to be done, how God has called us in the past and is still calling us today. It's an active engagement that means there are many things that come up in these discernment discussions that don't move beyond committee. But then when something comes before the congregation, it is done so with intention and great conviction that we are called to respond. Recently, there have been two justice issues that have come out of these teams that we feel Edgewood is called to respond to at this time. The first comes from the Open and Affirming team and the continued belief that all people in Michigan deserve to have their civil rights protected under the laws. Civil rights like knowing you won't be fired from a job or evicted from housing because of your gender expression or because of who you love. Right now, Michigan's civil rights law, the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act, includes religion, race, color, national origin, age, sex, height, weight, familial status, and marital status. It does not include sexual orientation or gender identity, meaning LGBTQ folks who do not have the same protections when it comes to work, housing, education, or public accommodations. For years, there have been discussions and efforts to change this to no avail. This year, a mass movement is underway in Michigan to get this issue on the ballot for November. To do this, 340,000 more signatures are needed before May. And I know that those of you who worked on the gerrymandering ballot initiative are now having flashbacks. Edgewood is being asked to join this justice movement by training folks to learn how to collect signatures, making sure everyone in our congregation has the opportunity to sign, and going into our community to spread the word. This Tuesday night from 7 to 8 p.m., we're hosting a training with Fair and Equal Michigan, the organization leading this effort, to find out all we need to start mobilizing. The training is right here at Edgewood, so you already know where to go. Working on this campaign is a dynamic way to show up and show out our support for the LGBTQ community. It's a campaign that's flexible in terms of time commitment and when you work on it. It is perfect for families of all ages, sizes, and configurations to do together in the name of making sure our children and grandchildren have protections that at one time some of us thought would never be possible. The second justice issue is one the racial justice team has been tuned into and discussing for almost a year now. We, like a growing number of communities across the country, have been concerned with the issue of police oversight. Ensuring that when an incident happens that involves our local law enforcement, there's the ability to have an impartial outside investigation instead of keeping it solely within the department. The Human Relations Commission in East Lansing, on which I serve, has been grappling with what this might look like in our community and how to go about forming it. The one constant in this conversation has been the understanding that it wasn't a matter of if we would need to call on a public oversight commission, it was a matter of when. When police officers in this community have up to 40,000 contacts with the public each year, it's like playing a game of roulette to think that there would never be something that happens or goes wrong. In the midst of these discussions, something did happen. This week, we saw photos of a young Tanzanian man whose face was bloodied and scarred after being assaulted during an arrest here in East Lansing. The reactions from folks have ranged from shocked that anything like this could happen in a police force that works to be community-minded and relationship-focused, to remembering discussions with many in our Black community who have publicly shared that they feel unsafe in East Lansing, primarily due to profiling and past troubling interactions with police here. While the investigation into this event unfolds, Edgewood's racial justice team is calling us on us to stand in support of the victim and to join the call for transparency in an outside investigation, along with a renewed commitment from the city to move toward a strong public safety oversight commission. So next Sunday afternoon at 1:30 p.m., there's a peaceful protest scheduled outside City Hall and the police station to stand against violence and to move toward a safer community for all people. I'm proud of the way our justice leaders discern directions for Edgewood to move, even as it challenges us. They recognize that growing from God often means taking a stand, finding our voice, and showing up in the community for justice and peace, even when it is not popular. It's how I know we wouldn't make a very good cult. Instead of false promises of luxury or safety, we tell people, when you come to Edgewood, you're going to be asked to take risks, to speak out, and it's not always going to feel comfortable. Welcome. But when we trace God's presence through past generations and through Scripture, usually when people start to get uncomfortable or are asked to do big things, that is when we most clearly see the presence of God. May we continue to follow God through seasons of growth, no matter where it takes us. Amen.